Hi, everybody.
Welcome. Welcome to this Ideas event. My name is Professor Mick Cox, Michael Cox, if you wish. I'm director of LSE Ideas, alongside another emeritus professor soon to be, Christopher Coker, from the IRD. And I'm delighted to welcome a very large audience here this evening to this great LSE event, at the great LSE, as I'm bound to say, if I want to get paid. No, I mean it. I was kind of thinking of some comments of great sagacity and historical wisdom to say before introducing this tonight, and this is what I'm going to say. There have been three iterations, it seems to me, of the notion of an Asian century. The first, some of you may be surprised to hear, came in 1904, 1905, when Japan defeated Russia. And this was seen at the time, perceived at the time, as the first time Asians had beaten white people. And it was read throughout the whole of the Asian world, many of the Asian world amongst intellectuals, as a statement about a coming Asian century. The great Indian Prime Minister, who had much to do with the LSE, although he didn't study here, Nehru, spoke about that victory as being a victory not just for Japan, but also a victory for Asia. Tragically, of course, that particular vision of an Asian century ended in total calamity. I suppose the second iteration of the Asian century was announced by Chairman Mao in 1949 in the context of a rising tide of revolution across Asia. Asia was, in a sense, the apex, the axis of that revolution. And that, again, was an announcement of another Asian century. And I'll leave you to decide how you think that ended. We are now, I suppose, in our third iteration of the Asian century. Certainly not militaristic, definitely not revolutionary in the ideological sense, but fundamentally, but not only, as Parag Khanna will describe here tonight, economic. And so that is what we are going to discuss here tonight. We might almost call it the third coming of an Asian century challenges for the West. I'm delighted to welcome here this evening three speakers. The first one, of course, who will open up. I'm not going to introduce him in great detail. He should be known by now. Parag Khanna, whose book is just out, The Future is Asian, Global Order in the 21st Century. He will open up the discussion, challenge your thoughts about Asia and the future. This will then be followed by Yujie Cherry, as we call her, Chinese research fellow at Chatham House, and still, of course, associated with LSE Ideas. And then Gideon Rackman of the Financial Times, chief foreign affairs commentator, will follow. I'll ask Parag to speak for about 20 minutes. He's a very disciplined young man. He did his PhD at the LSE, after all, so he's bound to be disciplined. And then I'll move on to Cherry and then finally to Gideon. So I wonder if you could put your hands together to welcome Parag Khanna back to the LSE.
Thank you so much. Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Mick, for that very generous introduction. Thank you, Cherry and Gideon, for joining. It is always very nostalgic to be back at the LSE. This place is very special in my heart, and obviously would lack the credibility to be standing before you had Mick not been the chair of my Viva committee, actually, and so graciously seen me through the process. So there is an end to it for all of you. I hope that I learned some discipline. I don't know if I learned how to use the AV equipment here, so I'm just going to click on this button and see if it works. Yes, there we go. So I want to open with maybe just 15 minutes or so of comments to maybe summarize a slice of the arguments from the book. And, you know, depending, Mick, I'll start with a response to what you were saying about, you know, which iteration number is this in terms of declaring the Asian century. And I think that it would really depend on what nomenclature was used and who was actually using that phrase at all in the first place. Because, of course, when I talk about the return of the Greater Asia, I'm looking back to the pre-colonial world entirely. I'm looking at the 16th century, a time where the term Silk Roads applied. And, of course, the fact that we have this term looking back at that period of history and that we can look at eras of history stretching it back even further, 1,500 years, 1,000 years, 500 years, indicates that there was a time when Asians had more to do with each other than they did with the rest of the world. So Asia had centuries of it being its own center of focus and attention, which I argue is becoming the case again today. And you'll see early in this book, in the first couple of pages, a homage to Barry Buzan. I don't know if Barry's here this evening, but Barry was my earliest and most rigorous supervisor in the program. And Barry has done obviously the most important work on the idea of a system. What are systems in international relations and in international history? And one of the critical elements of that is determining that. Aspects of a global system, regional system, and so forth. And loosely defined, a system is when the units have more intense interactions with each other than with units external to that system. But the phrase or the term system is most often applied to Western civilization, whether it's the transatlantic system or Europe as a system, of course, especially in the post-war decades. We don't often talk about Asia as a system. In fact, we don't talk about Asia as a system at all. And the point of departure of this book is to ask the question, is Asia becoming a system? And to do that, I wanted to look at some of the underlying kinds of metrics or measurements that we use when we use that term: the intensity of their trade relations, capital flows, migration, institutional formation, integration through diplomacy, and so forth. And I iterate in the book through that process and look at whether or not Asia is on the path towards becoming a system or not, and obviously the impact that that system has, because unlike, let's say, in the 20th century, where multiple times Asians may have used this phrase Asian century as a rallying cry, the underlying economic and strategic fundamentals were obviously not present. In the early 20th century, it was a part wrapped up in anti-colonial rhetoric, after all. That was a crucial part of the notion of Asia for Asians, as represented by intellectuals as from Persia to India to Japan in the early 20th century. Today is different, and let me point out why. And I'm going to try and achieve a couple of things at once with this particular slide. The first is to reinforce this notion about what is happening in the Asian economic space, which is, of course, the foundations of its global role and influence. And the second is to pull us away from the overly Sino-centric approach we have towards Asia, which is quite ahistorical. Because the... There we go. Okay. So, let's just remind everyone that the story of Asia's modern economic rise in the post-war decades begins, of course, not with China at all. It begins with Japan, right? And Japan in the post-war decades experienced its miraculous rise from the ruins of World War II and defeat to become the world's second largest economy within a mere, 30 or so years. And that Japanese economic miracle was, of course, the inspiration for the tiger economies that rose subsequently afterwards. Japan's modernization, industrialization helped to trigger the kinds of policies and reforms in the tiger economy, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore, with Hong Kong and Singapore obviously being the beneficiaries of having been European, British colonies in particular. Now, collectively, they experienced stratospheric economic rise, and remember that by the 1980s we were talking about Japan leading the Asian century and Japan being a geoeconomic threat to Western hegemony. So you could actually say, well, was that another premature vision or statement of the Asian century? And all of this is, of course, before 1979, before China's reforms kicked off. So we're now this year, of course, looking at the 40th anniversary of China's opening economically. And that's what I hold to be the third wave, right, of Asian economic growth in the post-war era. And here, too, we find, of course, that there was an inspirational effect and also obviously very material set of linkages between the incumbent, now prosperous, wealthy Asian countries, Japan and the Tigers, and the country emerging from feudalism, right, and from the Cultural Revolution and Great Leap Forward, and of course China. Now, which countries were the leading investors in making China what it is today? Who led that foreign investment wave? Who started doing the outsourcing to China in the first place? Right. Of course, it was its very own neighbors, and to this day, certainly Japan, quite obviously Taiwan, South Korea, and Singapore have among the most, if not the most, distributed, profitable, lucrative commercial networks all across China. So let's remember that China, in the ahistorical way we look at it today, as if it is some island floating above the world, above Asia. Is not some kind of a virgin birth story, right? It's actually the third wave and very directly following on, benefiting from its relationships with its immediate Asian neighbors. And the Asian story doesn't end there either, right? A part of the ahistoricalness of our view of China, and in particular in Asia in general, is that by holding the two to be synonymous, as we so often do, we ignore what came before, and we're missing a lot of what's already happening, and that is what I refer to as the fourth or current next wave of Asian growth. Not that these are mutually exclusive. Bear in mind, they are actually reinforcing each other through these waves in which the now aging but more sophisticated and wealthy Asian societies are investing in the next wave. Because here you have a set of countries from Pakistan through India and ASEAN, right, with a combined population of 2.5 billion people, which is obviously a billion more people than China alone has, with younger median age, and in many cases, faster growth rates than China. And of course, who is leading all of the investment into these countries that is helping them represent to be that next wave of growth? It is, of course, Japan, the Tiger economies, including Singapore, and China itself, whether it is through outbound investment, investment in technology, in industries, Belt and Road Initiative, you name it. So Asia is a mutually reinforcing and collective economic system. Now, within this, I think the next slide is this one. Yes. What you can already see is that in terms of measuring systemness, what has been true actually since 2004, which is quite a long time ago actually, and this is today's figures, Asians trade more with each other than with the rest of the world, right? It's been true since before the financial crisis. In fact, part of the reason Asian economies were resilient to the financial crisis is that because the Asian financial crisis came 10 years before the Western financial crisis, they began to rebuild, reform, restructure their economies, open more to trade, do all sorts of relatively, you know, sort of smart things that Western economists have also prescribed for a long time, like moving towards flexible exchange rates and, you know, building higher currency reserves and so forth, and also trade liberalization. So we've reached a stage where, given the complementarities that I was highlighting before, now I'm giving you the full set of complementarities across Asia, where you see that I've included Russia, who trades more with Asia now than it does with Europe. The GCC economies, beginning with the super cycle of the 1990s, in which energy flows began to shift much more across the Indian Ocean to fuel the high growth economies of East Asia, you can consider these economies, which are geographically West Asia, of course. Apologies for my lack of nostalgia for the term Middle East, which has no particular relevance when you think about the world from an economic or actual geographic point of view. It's a bit of colonial nostalgia doesn't really fit in my worldview. So you can clearly see the West Asian economies are quite tied up now with East Asia. If you pick any pair, really, of countries or subregions on this map, you'll find that their trade intensity has grown quite significantly over the last 15 years. So here you have the Asian trade system, and they continue to exploit and to develop the complementarities among them. You have financial centers, industrial centers, agricultural centers, commodities, exporters, and so forth. So Asians are quite comfortable in physically rebuilding the Silk Roads, if you will, that underpin these rising trade volumes. That brings me to Belt and Road, which is something that I've been looking at since long before it had a name. In fact, my first book, The Second World, I spent a fair bit of time documenting Chinese infrastructure projects across Central Asia, and I had been traveling, in those countries for about 20 years now. So Belt and Road has only been an acronym that is so talked about in the last couple of years, but before it had a name, these projects were well underway. You had Chinese pipelines reaching the Caspian Sea as far back as the late 1990s. You had the maritime sort of, you know, corridor, as I mentioned before. Now here on this map, I've put up the various projection. Some of these are already in place, of the railways, of the railways, pipelines, electricity grids, and so forth, that are helping Asians optimize their resources, right? The sort of optimization of land, labor, and capital is what's going on here. Now, remember that on this map, you have about more than 5 billion people, right? The majority of the human population lives inside this rectangle. Right? And that's always going to be true because the world population is actually starting to plateau. As many of you know, it may peak at somewhere under 10 billion people, and more than 5 billion people are right here. Now, for many of the post-colonial countries on this map, or post-Soviet republics, their populations have tripled, right, if not quadrupled, since the end of World War II, with very little in the way of new infrastructure finance. And hence, they've been quite enthusiastic about, broadly speaking, infrastructure initiatives, and in particular, many of these countries, of course, have joined Belt and Road. But I don't want to get too fixated on the term Belt and Road. I'm emphasizing here more the supply-demand gap in infrastructure. Now, you can imagine that as all of these infrastructure projects progress around energy transfer, trade routes, and so forth, you're going to have an ever greater volume of intra-Asian trade that's going to drive this system. I will make a point now, though, a geopolitical one about Belt and Road, because I think many of us have taken it to be a sort of Chinese hegemonic plot. I'll say two things, or three things about that. The first is that, in a way, for anyone who's a student of geopolitics, you're familiar with the term Malacca trap, right? And East Asian countries east of the Strait of Malacca acutely suffer from that Malacca trap because the vast majority of their commodities, raw material inflows come through the Strait of Malacca right there in the southern tip of the map. Mick, you can even reach and point to Singapore right there. Let's get there. It is excellent. Down there. So we've got the Strait of Malacca there. And the vast majority, just making sure you're awake, Mick.
I was still there.
I admit, during my vibe, I was very boring. So I just And of course, the vast majority of their finished goods outflow flows through the same corridor. So in some ways, Belt and Road has a defensive characteristic or motivation in the sense that what country would want to be hostage to a narrow channel of water that you don't control? Secondly, as I mentioned before, a lot of countries need this, and building that resilience of infrastructure to connect China to West Asian energy supplies and to Europe, its largest trading partners across Asia, is obviously something that's very constructive, useful, and mutually beneficial. Final point on just the geopolitics is that we tend to think of this infrastructure build-out as a one-way street, sort of wherever China builds something, it heavily indebts an economy, creates a debt trap, and forces some kind of asset transfer debt for equity swap. But that's not a universal phenomenon. It's only happened in a couple of cases. And my contention, as I spell out in the book by looking country by country, is that, you know, the case of Sri Lanka, which we're all now familiar with, Hambantota Port, where because there was a, you know, near default, at least the conventional wisdom is there was a near default, and therefore in order to avoid that situation, Sri Lanka granted a 99-year lease over ownership and usage of the Hambantota port in southern Sri Lanka to China. And, you know, from that point on, in our sort of, you know, Western press and narrative, that was the first domino to fall, right? The rest of the Belt and Road countries, the small coastal littoral Indian states, are all going to fall like dominoes before China. Instead, what I think has happened is that was the first and the last domino. Because unlike a colonial era where colonies don't have any agency, what has happened in this modern world of sovereignty, of democracy, of transparency, of scrutiny over Chinese projects, of the feedback loops, is that every other country after Sri Lanka made its sort of, you know, ill-fated move or concession, every other country that you see here, their cabinet, Their cabinets met on Monday morning, and they said, how can we avoid being the next Sri Lanka, right? And as a result, what we've seen in the last 18 months is country after country not fall like dominoes to China's, you know, so-called debt trap diplomacy, but instead to renegotiate with China. Pakistan has massively reduced the value of the China-Pakistan economic corridor. Myanmar has been able to reduce its debt to China. Malaysia has canceled projects. If this were a colonial world, countries like with such a power asymmetry and no leverage whatsoever over China would not have that ability to say no. But we don't live in a colonial world. Analogies between the Belt and Road and the British East India Company, therefore, a very limited utility. Now, I had one other point, but I can make it without reference to a map. I mentioned that in the previous slide that Europe lies there off to the west, western fringe there. And indeed, if you couple the data I was showing you earlier around the trade volumes within Asia, that is China's largest set of trading partners. Like I said, Asians trade more with each other than they do with any other region of the world. Asia's second largest set of trading partners is Europe. Right, larger than the United States by quite a bit, by about $500 to $600 billion a year more is Asian trade with Europe. Now, we have been looking at the world, sort of in the contemporary news headline-driven world with the U.S.-China trade war being the kind of driving axis of sort of shaping global trade patterns and relations and so forth. But no such thing is actually true. What you see happening is that China, in response to the trade war, is going to go all out in its efforts to permanently substitute any dependence it has on American supplies and suppliers in such a way that will make it further integrated within Asia, because many of the things that it gets from the United States, including sensitive technologies, semiconductors, and so forth, it can and will instead get from Taiwan, from South Korea, from Japan, countries that are more than willing to actually substitute the United States and sell and profit in the Chinese market. So you don't see a trade war between South Korea, Japan, and China. Instead, you see further trade liberalization between them. They equally fear China's move up the value chain, right, and some of their industries and companies being displaced. But for the time being, they're more than willing to profit from it. So a reminder to the United States would be that your geopolitical allies are not necessarily your geoeconomic allies in the context of trade war, which has multiple players. Europe is very important in this regard because there are many other categories of goods and services trade where Europe would gladly substitute for the United States. If China and Asian countries are going to buy less Boeing aircraft, there is a company called Airbus. I'm sure you've heard of it. And they're more than willing to, rather than just have 50% market share among China's dozen or more airlines, take that up to 60% or 70%. And I have no doubt that that is something that the Chinese government is thinking very strongly about doing. And on it goes. So in a multipolar world, at least economically multipolar world, I see Asia is now taking its sort of rightful place, if you will, alongside the other poles. The rise of Asia does not mean the decline of the West, and the West itself is splintering in some ways because you clearly see Europe pursuing a geoeconomic agenda that's much more premised on convergence in some ways with Asia, even though they share some of the same concerns about Chinese intellectual property theft and so forth. But still, it is a tripolar world economically and strategically in many ways, and Europe is going to act ever more independently within that. And what we see with the Asianization of Asia and the Eurasianization of trade is that the two most significant poles in that, at least from an economic standpoint, are going to be Europe and Asia, and that's why that also is a big set of arguments in the book. I won't get into all of the issues around political evolution and reform. I'm sure we're going to have plenty of time to talk about all of that, but that's just to kick things off. Again, thank you so much.
Sherry, do you want to go up there? Yeah, go up there, if you can work your way around. Okay, thank you very much. Thanks, Sherry. All right. So, thanks, sir. That was great.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. And I'm really surprised to see so many, students here tonight, because I know as the academic year progressing, probably this week and next few weeks is the most busiest period for the entire academic year. I used to teach in this place, and I feel so much detached and emotionally still detached to this place. So glad to be back. Now, Parag and also Mick was giving us some historical lessons about the Asian century. Mick was talking about 100 years ago, and Parag was talking about, you know, back to 18th century, and then back to 1949. And actually, I will go a little bit further, back to 3,000 years ago. You know, this whole... this whole notion of the Chinese view of the world, so-called 天下, I'm sure many Chinese speakers here would know what I mean by it. So the whole notion of 天下 is driven from the, not Confucius, but Monfuscius, the whole line about how to behave yourself, and then organizing a good family, and run the country in a good order, and then you can dominate the world. So... Yeah. So that's the view of the Chinese, and they still hold nowadays. You know, 齐家治国，修身平天下. The final line is you have to be a good person first in order to run the world. Now, if we enter into the modern era, and let's just observe the China's behavior in the so-called coming Asian century. And obviously, China's make up a significant part of the story of the so-called Asia's rising. And then in terms of translate its own foreign policy, and what China has done in the past 70 years or so, and I summarize within the three letters beginning with M, which is China is exercising its own economic and military might, spending money, buying friends, and, you know, using the exorbitant financial resources to buy political influence. But lastly, and most importantly, which I'm going to talk about tonight, is how to change people's mindsets towards China. You know, that sense of discursive power. So these three elements of M, and each of those have somehow connect to each other. And those each M's have somehow different from the Western liberal democracy. And that's the China nowadays we have. I mean, as the economic goes, as China's economic power increasing, and, you know, the sheer size of the country, even without President Xi Jinping being in power, somehow forcefully promote assertive foreign policy, and China is not by no way going to satisfy what's going on with the international affairs nowadays, and in particularly within how the international politics being organized, and in terms of global governance, in terms of, you know, voting rights within WTO or IMF. So inevitably, China was actually looking for challenging the existing configuration of the international affairs. So that's one thing we're going to facing, that elongated battle between China and the West, to that sense. Now, how successful that's going to be, I think we're probably too early to draw that conclusion for the moment. Because what I've foreseen so far is on this, you know, Parag was talking about how much money China spent on the Belt and Road and, you know, how much military exercises and China's been navigating through South China Sea. And for me, really the most worrying sign for me is how China now going to challenging the so-called existing rule-based international order. And this is perhaps something going to be a much longer battle to fight between China and the West. And what China has introduced now is, we all admit, China is a major great power, but it's not yet the major great power. So by not being the major great power, and what China produces is that sense of discursive power. We do things differently. By no way China is going to share the same values and ideologies like this part of the world. And also China felt it's not just China itself doesn't share that ideologies and values, but more importantly, is China being the representative of a large non-Western countries, non-Western developing countries realize their own voices, their voting shares, and have not really been well represented in the international order nowadays. And that's what China seems to do, its own mission to do so. Now, there's a very interesting concept President Xi Jinping has kept talking about in the last 5 years, which is so-called democratization of international relations. Don't get me wrong, what he's talking about, democratization of international relations, is not to introduce the so-called civil societies and non-governmental organizations playing a much bigger role in the international affairs. And what he's introducing instead is the whole world has no hegemony, and each power should respect each other, and each power should respect their own sovereignties and differences, and therefore we return the world without any so-called hegemony and the great powers, and each one is really respectful to each other. So China's whole notion of the five principles of peaceful coexistence, which is the fundamental element of the Chinese foreign policy, and that really embedded on that notion of the so-called international the democratization of international affairs. So that's the view of the Xi Jinping for his worldview. So having said all of that, if you carefully look at how China behaves internationally, what you have realized is China not just seeking to revolutionize or overturn the international system as a whole completely. And you actually realize the certain convergence China is trying to do and try to work within the existing international framework, try to change the global institutions. But in some other areas, and China indeed actually looking for something completely new, like, for example, cyber sovereignty. And Xi Jinping introduced the notion of cyber sovereignty, and which means cyberspace should also belong to one space of within one country rather than transnational issues, as many of you who come across in here. So that's the differences and similarities between China and the West. Now, given all of that, it now becomes more complicated to deal with China, because by we're not knowing on which part of the element of international relations China is looking for revolutionize and which part China is not. But what we can see so far is no matter how much China is talking about respecting rule of international relations, respect rule-based international order, and domestically, by no way China is going to share that sense of liberal norms. And instead, what we foresee is in the past 5 years, what we realize is the space of discussing alternative views and alternative values and alternative political system, somehow that space has reduced significantly during Xi Jinping come to power, and that's one thing. And secondly, what we have witnessed the Chinese political elites somehow forcefully present a very proud picture, a very confident picture of China to its own domestic audience. So over the last 18 months or so, I've noticed President Xi made so many big speeches, and all of them sound very similar to me, and I summarize for the 4 words, and which have keep come across. The one word is on confidence. China should have the confidence to looking for alternative values, alternative political system. And second is difference. China respects differences of how the world of international politics should organize, and China also urge the other country should respect China's difference as well. And the thirdly, which is on leadership, China should really forcefully shoulder more leadership responsibility in the space. And the lastly is destiny. Come back to earlier when I was talking about Tianxia, you know, the whole worldview of China is destined to rule, to be the center of the world, that sense of destiny and, you know, destination. So these are the 4 words, and Xi Jinping keeps emphasizing on his foreign affairs and somehow translated into domestic politics. I mean, all that sounds very well, but what we have now is we're now having this a very slowdown economy and coupled together with that elongated U.S.-China trade war. And how capable President Xi will be able to resolve that crisis, I think we're still debating and we're not really sure. And how are we going to end it for something American is asking for, the structural change of Chinese economy? That's something seems it will not happen overnight. And China will do whatever it can to resist that change, because there's a deep sense of pride within the Chinese population themselves, proud of their own systems. Now, another element which I picked up in the recent years is that really the resurgence of a strong sense of nationalism. And many of you have perhaps been following the story on Huawei, following the story on the battles between China and Canada. And for me, what I found really the debate is lacking in the Western media is that sense, perhaps in this part of the world, and people don't quite understand how much China felt itself has not really been respected, firstly, internationally. And then secondly, you know, that whole notion of 150 years victimization, victimhood, and somehow that picture got presented inside the Chinese society, got reinforced during Xi Jinping's era again and again. So all in all, that really required the Chinese government to have a strong response to the Kenyan government and try to tell them, look, because it's the Chinese Communist Party have the legitimacy to make sure its own population, its own citizens would not be bullied. And therefore what Canadian has done is really directly to challenge the governing legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. So that's a very really complex picture we're talking about in here. And if you're talking about the challenge of the West, really for me, my urge would be in here is if we're talking about the challenges, the really crucial thing is have really the West understand, firstly, the Communist Party very well, and secondly, has the West really understand this Communist Party, which is constantly changing, and which is constantly trying to adapt and try to look for survival? And perhaps the answer is no. And just careful with the word when the Chinese Communist Party describes itself. It's not a governing party, but it's a ruling party, which means once if you're a ruling party, and there's no chance to lose the power, because that's the only country, that's the only party, that's it. But then somehow, if the West is really seeking to change the Chinese behavior domestically, I'm afraid the West is going to fail very miserably. And the harder they try, perhaps the harder backlashes you will receive, not just among the Chinese older generation, but really among the Chinese younger generation. And that's, for me, more alarming. And this, perhaps, the West have to deal with in the next 50 years or so. Now, just to conclude, I mean, one of the lessons what China has really learned in the last years or so, you know, the burden of being a great power and the challenge of being a great power, and those challenges will not go away. And 2019 will not be easier of anywhere else for China, because we are now facing a very few sensitive anniversaries inside China in this 2019. So we had, you know, the splendid moment of 1949 and 1979 redefine the country. But we also have the darkest hour of 1989 and also the controversy around 1919. So how the Chinese Communist Party, on the one hand, dealt with the foreign affairs issues, you know, the uneasy relation with the United States, then on the other, to satisfy its domestic audience, to make sure it still present itself, giving some kind of credibility to run the country. And I'm afraid that's one thing Xi Jinping will have to have answer in a matter of next 2 weeks or so. But I end in here, and much look forward to hear your questions and answers.
Last but by no means least, Gideon Rackman. Gideon.
Thanks, Mick, and thanks to the LSE and to the two previous speakers for setting up the discussion. I won't take very long. I'd just like to maybe respond to some of what the two previous speakers said to open up the discussion. I mean, it seemed to me that Parag raises a couple of very interesting questions in his presentation. Firstly, when we talk about the rise of Asia, is it possible to make this a discussion about Asia as a whole, or are we really talking about China? I think he's certainly right that in the Western debate, China obscures everything else. But is that right or is that wrong? I'd like to talk a little bit about that. And the second is this whole question, is the future Asian? I think the central problem about that is there such a thing as Asia strategically, or is Asia so divided that actually the United States, the incumbent superpower, will be able to kind of redefine the zone as it's attempting to, calling it the Indo-Pacific, and continue to be the balancing force and in some ways the dominant force in the region, because there is no such thing as Asia. And I guess, you know, when I took my own stab at this subject, I read a book called Easternization a couple of years ago. I came out in a similar sort of place to Parag, in that I think that there has been a shift of power to Asia. In fact, I even dared to use the D word, the decline word, which Parag is too polite to use when applying to the United States. But I think that inevitably there is a shift of power. You can't have a rising superpower such as China without it having some implications for the powers of the incumbent, the United States. But, almost for the sake of discussion and argument, I mean, I think you can certainly make the opposite case, and these are questions I wrestle with in my own book, and I know that Parag does as well. So to take those two questions, is this all about China or about a broader Asia? I mean, clearly, there are other great powers in the region. India is another country of over a billion people. Japan is the third largest economy in the world. South Korea, even though with a much smaller population, is a significant global economy. And yet it seems to me that you could say that the story of the last 20, 30 years or so has actually been of China opening the gap and of China increasingly eclipsing the other powers in the region. So that if you started in 1980, just after the reform and opening, the economies of China and India were roughly the same size. The economy of China is now five times the size of India. So even if you see the comparative growth rates, you might say, oh, well, look, India's currently growing like one percentage point faster than China. So, but it's not catching up. Because the Chinese economy is so much larger, the gap's actually growing and growing and growing. And I had an interesting conversation about this in the office of the chief economic advisor to the Indian government. There's a guy called I think he's just left, Arvind Subramanian. Mm. But he was wearing two hats because he'd written this book called Eclipse about how China was going to eclipse the United States, eclipse everybody. And I was interested to see whether in this new role, talking up India, and he was certainly, as a representative of the Modi government, a representative of a very bullish government, the kind of people who support Modi in India, it seemed to me, so one of them put it to me, their feeling was that China was on the slide, India was on the rise, the next 20, 30 years were going to be all about India, just as the previous 30 years had been all about China. And so I put that to Arvind and said, well, you sticking with the book or are you sticking with, you know, your role as an Indian government official? And I was pleased to see that as a true intellectual, he stuck with his book rather than his job and said, no, look, you know, the gap between China and India is still growing and we mustn't talk ourselves into this idea that we're anywhere close to challenging them in terms of pure economic might. And that this clearly also had geopolitical implications, certainly sitting in Delhi, because although India now is beginning to, in a way that's analogous to the way that Cherry was talking about, to feel that the world needs to be reshaped a bit, you know, that the institutions of the post-45 era were created actually when India wasn't even independent yet, and that needs to change. I think China is more ambitious and has more might to deploy, frankly. And so that there is a sort of fear of encirclement that's taking hold in India. Parag referred to the Sri Lanka case, but of course they look at the close relationship that China now has with Pakistan, with Myanmar, and they're beginning, there's clearly a strategic competition and one that the Indians are anxious about. So, again, if you look at the network of trade that Parag put up there, I was looking at it from a side angle, but I would guess that China is very much at the center of it, that for all the countries that are the strategic allies of the United States, the big problem is that they all have their major trading relationship now with China, including Japan, including Australia, including India, South Korea, certainly. And that means that their ability to push back against Chinese wishes is limited. So it was interesting being in Seoul recently, where the South Koreans had a very difficult diplomatic time with the Chinese over their decision to allow the deployment of missiles, American missiles, in South Korea, and that the Chinese had punished them by, you know, closing down South Korean-owned department stores in China, cutting back the flow of tourists, and so on. And that could have sparked a real diplomatic rift. But as far as I could work out, the South Korean reaction was, as soon as things quietened down, to start really trying to rebuild things with China. And I think their view was they didn't really have much option because China was so important. They're tacked onto the South Korean peninsula is, you know, tacked onto the Chinese mainland, that they couldn't really sustainably opt for a policy of confrontation over the long term with China, even though they are completely dependent on the United States in security terms. So that seemed to me a sense of how things are going and how they're going to go, at least for a while, that China's economic might, its presence, is growing all the time. And that means that the story of Asia is, to a significant extent at the moment and probably for the next few years, about the growing power of China and how everyone's response to that, rather than about a whole bunch of different poles all growing at the same time. But then I think that's in economic terms, and that obviously has a geopolitical effect. But there is this broader question about, well, is there such a thing as Asia because of these divisions? And as Parag said, and as Cherry alluded to, of course, the rise of this power, the growing sense that China is becoming both more important and more assertive, does create nervousness, and that creates an opening for the United States. And so When we talk about, well, the future is Asian, or the Asian century, or Westernization, as I put it, I think a big question anybody talking about that has to answer is, well, you know, does the analogy, the implied analogy with the West, actually work? Because the West exists politically. There are Western political institutions. There's NATO, above all. And, of course, there are divisions within the West, particularly sharp at the moment, and there's a question about whether NATO will survive. But there is an alliance. There is no Asian alliance. The Asia is very, very divided politically, so that a lot of the China's neighbors and major trading partners are actually in alliance with the United States. The US-Japan Security Treaty, the US-South Korea Security Treaty, Australia, and so on. And I guess the central tension about the future of Asia, and because Asia's so central to the global economy now, about the future of the world, is how is that going to play out? Are these countries going to try to stick with America in security terms, and will their security anxieties mean that ultimately they go with the United States if they're asked, put on the you know, spot and made to ask to make choices? And you could see that perhaps with Japan, which I think is very uneasy about a lot of what Trump's doing on trade, but is trying a policy at the moment of just hugging America closer and closer, whatever they think of Trump, because they are scared about the rise of China, and in the end this is an existential thing for them. Or will they, over time, decide, you know what, the economic ties with China are so important, the Americans are increasingly flaky and unreliable, we're going to have to reorient. As I say, I think that at the moment, most countries in the region are doing a variant of what, well, most, yeah, most of America's key allies are sticking with America. The Australians have written a whole white paper on foreign policy, which is very kind of pro-American, more strongly so than even in the recent past. The South Koreans are in a weird situation because of their own internal divisions and the North Korean problem, but are dependent in security terms on the U.S., and that's going to last for a while. But if anyone defects, I would guess it would be South Korea first. And then other countries, you could go through it country by country. The situation varies, and it often is dependent on political change internally, so that Malaysia seemed to be tacking towards China, but then you get the fall of Najib and Mahathir coming in and taking a more anti-Chinese line. So these things, it's not going to be one-way traffic, but I think that increasingly, as the relationship between the US and China becomes more antagonistic, it's going to be harder for the other countries in the region to ride both horses, which points to this, I think, underlying question that both people like Parag and myself, who've written about the rise of Asia, have to deal with, which is the rise of Asia ultimately going to be checked because of internal rivalries and the way in which the great outside power, an Asia-Pacific power, now restyling itself as an Indo-Pacific power, but the role of the United States can't be ignored, and there's a lot for the U.S. to operate with, because a lot of countries still want it in the region because they are scared of each other and particularly scared of China. So I'll leave it there.
Okay, thanks very much. Thank you very much, Gideon. I do know where the Malaccan Straits is now. That's good. Thank you for that. That's great. I knew it before. Parag, I'm going to be a bit naughty and ask you hopefully very difficult questions which you won't be able to answer. I thought you painted a very benign picture of connectivity, to use a phrase that you have used on many, many occasions before. It all seemed like a nice liberal interdependent world, and people just had a few misunderstandings and, you know, one or two things along the line, but there wasn't very much going on there which sounded like conflict or power or the sort of stuff I know that you don't like, which is what John Mearsheimer writes about. So I just wonder, really, if your benign picture actually is real. After when a great power rises economically, as Gideon pointed out, that then translates into power, and that translates into greater confidence, is the term which was frequently used there. Greater assertiveness. I know that's not a phrase that people in Beijing like to use, but it's people in the region use quite a lot, by the way. So I just wonder, firstly, if yours is not really a far too benign picture. Let me be a horrible, mean, green-eyed monster realist and kind of bring you back to reality, Parag. The other point I want to make is about the United States. I mean, I have to say, the United States sounded like Luxembourg in your analysis there. You know, there's this kind of thing over there, the other side of the Pacific, which is kind of, well, you know, it's kind of America, you know, but it's all over here, you know. Well, I don't know. I do go to China quite a lot, and Terry knows I go there. I've been teaching at Bidar for many years. I'm a great admirer of Chinese achievements and a critic too, as you know, friend of China, but critical. I have to say, when I go to Beijing, they're obsessed by the United States. They're not obsessed by Europe. In fact, I don't think I understand what the European Union is. They talk about it, they worry about it, they're concerned about it, they study it, they think about it, and they're deeply concerned, as far as I can see, by Trump. And they're deeply concerned about this so-called trade war. And, you know, that's why they've been spending so much time, effort, and money, and no doubt many, many other things beside, trying to do something about it. So I just wondered if you didn't kind of relegate the United States to a kind of walk-on part, rather than make it much more central in what I think is Chinese thinking. And finally, I detect, and there'll be all sorts of different explanations as to why this is going on. But as I said to Cherry, and I did a panel the other day with some business people, and I said, look, I went through all these U.S. national security documents over a whole year and a half, and it wasn't much fun reading. It was a horrible Christmas, by the way. And what was striking, and I don't know if you picked this up as well, by the way, Gideon, the turn in, it's not a turn, but the emphasis now on China as a revisionist power, China as the great challenge to the United States, it's right across the political spectrum too. It's not just the Republicans, it ain't just Trump, it's the Democrats as well. You see this on the trade thing. And by the way, I think that although, you know, we like to think of the Europeans as being nice and cuddly, and Volkswagens and, you know, all sorts of other stuff. And the Americans do, you know, aircraft carriers and nasty stuff like that. Hard power, soft power, economic power and all the rest. Nonetheless, I've seen a pushback, even in the European debate, on China. So it's not just Trump, it's also much wider across the American political spectrum on the kind of fear of China, now legitimate or otherwise, illegitimate, wrong, misinformed or whatever. But I also detect that, and I'd also like to get your feelings on this, Cherry-Anne, on that. So why is, not why is that happening, we'll have a big debate about that going forever, but it is happening, and it does seem to me it's creating this, I suppose to use the old phrase, a security dilemma, which is not just one that the United States is getting itself locked into with China and China with it, but also many in the European Union are saying not entirely dissimilar things. I'll let Parag have a go.
Sure, thank you.
Impossible to answer questions.
Not at all. If you had given me just five more minutes, I would have included responses to all of those.
I'm sure you've got plenty to say.
The first point is about the geopolitical rivalries within Asia, which both yourself and Gideon mentioned. Now, I've been looking at the conflict formations within Asia, as of all of you, for a long time. There's at least nine major significant rivalries, historical tensions, active, hostile dyads between Asian countries or territories. We had a flare-up between India and Pakistan just last week. We've had between China and India the summer of 2017 in the Doklam Plateau. We have Taiwan, North, South Korea, China, Japan, at least 10. It is inherent in the nature of a system that there be friction. The evidence that you have a system of units that have intense interactions with each other is not merely measured by the sort of, you know, fluidity of trade and commerce, but by the frictions. That is the proof of the system. So at no point did I ever use the word peaceful as a modifier to the word system. And it is, in fact, evidence of a system that you have war, tension, and conflict. One of the first things you learn when you study systems under Barry Buzan, as you all should. Too late for some of you, unfortunately. But it's critical to understand that, again, that friction is evidence of a system, and whether or not those frictions are overcome, conflictually or peacefully, is almost irrelevant, actually, to the ultimate end state. Imagine North Korea as an example. You could have war in North Korea between North and South, and it could draw in the United States, or you could have a peaceful unification. The end state, 5, 10, 15 years from now, is, in fact, the same, which is that you do have some kind of an integration, commercially, diplomatically, some kind of rehabilitation in some way, shape, or form of that entity that will at some point formerly be known as North Korea, right? And the same goes for other situations. So war is not an argument against anything that I've said. It's simply part of the process. The other thing is that I think we have, and this happens all the time, but a conversation about Asia, because Asia is broad and is not a single coherent state-like unit, drifts into a conversation about China. And I've only sort of partially made the case. I make a much deeper case in the book, and I tried, at least economically, I think, made a clear-cut case that there is a much larger Asia than just China, notwithstanding the current gap between them and the fact that even a higher growth rate doesn't necessarily close the gap. But the broader issue is that we tend to not ascribe any agency to anyone in any conversation about geopolitics other than the United States and China. But the history of great powers, the history of empires, teaches us that others have a voice, that they can say no, that empires and superpowers don't get what they want. And as someone who even served in the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan, I know very well that superpowers don't always get what they want. So why is it that we only talk about China's confidence, China's ambition, China's desires, China's plans, and never that which can be done by others to resist and to reframe? Because others also have confidence. It is not for China alone to decide whether or not its assets in the Indian Ocean, its expansionist naval policy, is going to succeed or not. Quite frankly, that's very much in the hands of India and America and many others that are also building up their naval power. So there will be instances where Chinese power will be asserted, and it will create new facts on the ground, and it will certainly lead to a shift in the geopolitical calculus in that geography. I would nominate the South China Sea as an obvious example of that. I would certainly foresee that the Indian Ocean will be the opposite outcome in that regard. And it would be far too soon for anyone to predict that China's at present almost non-existent presence in the Indian Ocean compared to what it could be and compared to what others have, is on this linear pathway towards a thousand-year plot, you know, to achieve what it wants. Because what we've learned is that thousand-year plots don't tend to unfold the way they are intended. Even a 300-year plot or a 30-year plot tends to not exactly play out. It was surely in this room, not less than 20 years ago, after the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, that we were talking about America the hyperpower, right? And America the colossus. Where has that gone, right? So let's be clear that we cannot take at face value anything about any one country, even China, and nor America's, as we've learned, projections and vision for itself as if others don't have a vision. That brings me to the point about Asia again. At no point did I ever talk about the Asian system as being unified. Because we have a Eurocentric lens and are trained in theories that derive from European history, we tend to associate the term system or even a regional formation as having, if it does not have a teleology towards supranational unity or integration, therefore it is not a system. But Asia has 4,000 years of history that is almost entirely multipolar. You're talking about very large, discrete, mutually unintelligible civilizations brimming with millennia of confidence and identity, none of which have ever really bowed to the other since the Mongol Empire, which was a very, very long time ago. So the notion, even it is so theoretically inflected, the notion that China as a rising power is simply a 21st century version of America, and power transitions necessarily flow from one great power, superpower like Britain to the United States, and therefore either to China or remaining in the United States, is a completely fallacious theoretical prism that has almost no bearing whatsoever on 4,000 years of Asian history and tells us absolutely nothing about the future of this region of 5 billion people, which is segmented into at least 5 or 6 major civilizational zones, none of which really will bow before the others. And what we're increasingly seeing, again, is not a 300-year period in which Asians are able to assert themselves and to push back and to limit Chinese dominance or hegemony, but in only 3 years we've seen that process play out, and that's before Asian countries other than China actually achieve anything like their actual potential. So I see Asia returning, if anything, very, very predictably, almost on cue, to the patterns that have defined it for a long time, which is multipolarity, and there will be conflict within that. The subtitle of the book is, the American edition, is Conflict, Commerce, Conflict, and Culture. There'll be plenty of conflicts in Asia, but that will not invalidate the notion that it's a system. And just a final quick point about the United States is that, again, it is not a contiguous Asian power, right? All of its interests are being negotiated right now in real time. And the example of South Korea, the example of Japan, the example of Australia and India should open up our thinking not towards a mentality where we are back in the Cold War game of painting countries either red or blue. Because that is exactly what we are habituated to do from the Cold War era. But we are in a new psychological frame of what I've long called multi-alignment, where you cannot find me any country, and Gideon cited exactly those, that don't want to choose sides, and therefore they will not choose sides. They will not, they will never choose sides. You cannot find me an Asian country that's not, on the one hand, pursuing tighter, you know, strategic bonds potentially with the United States, but also with China. You have Australia that wants China to come into the joint naval exercises, which America does not want. You have the countries that are forming the Quad Alliance with the U.S. You have countries engaging in arms transfers. There are Asian approaches that are entirely to their own geopolitical alignments or realignments that are not factored in or discussed at all when we only talk about what America wants versus what China wants as if it is a binary choice, because it's not, and that's not the way 90% of Asians see it.
Okay, good. I think there's disagreement. And we'll vote down here, and then we'll throw it over to the floor. Yeah, Gideon, and then Cherry, quickly.
Okay,
yeah.
So just a couple of responses to Parag. I mean, I think you raise a interesting. I thought you were being a little bit sanguine about war. I mean, I think if there was a war on the Korean Peninsula, it would make, you know, they'll end up in a slightly different position if they're than peaceful reunification. But I'm not totally poo-pooing your point. I mean, because of course, even the rise of Asia has been punctuated by horrible wars, the Korean War, exactly, the Vietnam War, etc. And it's the case also, I mean, in the period of European dominance, when Europe was remaking the world, colonizing the world, European powers were consistently at war with each other. So it didn't stop the rise of Europe. But at a certain point, the wars did get so out of hand that you have the First and Second World Wars, which I think do mark the eclipse of European power. Mm-hmm. So it depends how constrained these conflicts are. But a really serious conflict in Asia, or even, you know, a really serious Cold War in Asia, if things, say, got really bad between China and Japan, or China and India, which disrupted the economic relations very seriously, I think would put a crimp in this idea of a system emerging and becoming more and more powerful. And then the second point, I think that, you know, again, just listening to you talk, and is it, well, what brings an end to a period? It was war that I think ended the period of European dominance of the globe. But the end of the Cold War, I think, highlighted another important point, which is that often we can be so fixated with international relations and systems that we forget about the internal dimension. In the end, it's the sort of internal collapse of the Soviet Union that kind of ends the Cold War. And I guess the big question mark about the Asian century is the internal stability of China. I mean, so that China has surprised the world and surprised the West by being much, much more stable than anyone thought. And, of course, we're coming up to the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, and if you had said in 1989, you know what, by 2019, the Chinese Communist Party will still be in power and the Chinese economy will be the largest in the world by some measures, everyone said, you're kidding, you know, that's not going to work. They're going to have to make a choice. They're going to have to work this out. So maybe China's much more stable than we thought. But I don't think the story's written yet. And if there's a big explosion in China or a big political transformation, that obviously will affect the central power in Asia, but I think also all the neighbouring countries.
That's a segue to you, I think, Cherry.
Sure.
And then we'll open it up for Q&A. Yeah.
Very much so. I mean, this whole notion of the party and longevity and survival is all about this obsession with the stability.
Yeah.
It's all about after the Soviet Union. I mean, I can't tell you how much money the Chinese Communist Party spend to learn the demise of the Soviet Communist Party. That number, that was 4 million...
Money well spent.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure it's well spent or something else.
I don't agree.
But certainly it's a hard lesson to learn.
If you're looking for research funding.
Certainly it's a hard lesson to learn, and the number that they have spent in total is about £4 million, you know, in total. Anyway, just to follow up on your point, I think that this whole notion of China and the West, or China within the Asian countries, somehow returned really on that, the argument of China has been somehow become too self-centered. It's all about perception, because this is a country. It's not a country where it starts from 5,000 years ago as the civilization, as Xi Jinping put forward to. This is a modern state, only emerged itself at the center of international affairs since 1979. So it has only been 40 years, and China has to learn how to behave like great power. And of course, once you behave with great power, and you're required to have a you know, if you want to run a global leadership, you do need to have a followers, and you need to be concerned about perceptions of the other people. Not just the perception, not just the positive perception, but more importantly, why people or why the certain countries are fear of interact with China. And I think that's somehow the Chinese diplomacy has failed quite miserably and largely ignored how the perception of the others towards China, rather than how China perceived the others. So, and because also because that perception is going to be forcing on the policymakers who are based on that perception to make decisions. And inevitably, it's a negative image, and of course, the policy will follow that trend.
Okay, Jack, I think now time for questions. Where's the microphones?
We're going to be here all night.
Oh, God. Well, there are one mic. Oh, we've got two. LSE has been spending money. why don't we take this gentleman and that lady there?
I want a T-shirt.
And, there's a gentleman there with a beard and a gentleman there. I'll take four at a time. Yeah. Hi. Could you stand up, Ian? Just easier. And shout.
My question touches on the area of stability, which has been raised by Gideon and Sherry. Many of the assumptions made about China's future economic growth, influence and power are predicated on the premise that China will remain a single...
Can you hear at the back? You're going to talk to them, not to me.
Really
My question is that many of the assumptions made about China's future economic growth, power and influence are predicated on the premise that it will remain a single political entity. And my question is that given some of the regional and provincial political tensions within the country, is there the possibility that China could implode and fragment as did the Soviet Union?
Dr. Yu, thank you for your insights. I'd like to ask two questions. The first one is following up on your quote from Mu Zi. What do you make of China launching the first ever quantum satellite named after Mu Zi, and how might that affect the technology power compared with the US? The second question is, given the brouhaha over how Facebook and other Silicon Valley companies have either damaged or are destroying Western liberal democracy, what is the likelihood of a flight to China's version of the cyber sovereignty model?
Take one question at a time, no multiple warheads.
All right.
Please, sir.
Thank you all. We didn't talk about currency. We didn't talk about the role of renminbi and US dollar and how much of that is the undercurrent of the erosion of this dominance. And when we talk about critical infrastructure, how much of the same from China's lens is the dependence on U.S. dollar when it comes to the next sanctions, if you could talk on that.
Currency question, gentleman next to him. I'll take these four just to start off.
Thank you for the lecture. So I agree with that, the idea that China will end up like a Western-style society is a nonsense. China will remain China. So secondly, since the Western democracy become more and more incompetent to deal with the global and domestic crisis. So, yeah. So my question is that... will China model be extensively replicated by other countries in the future? And will the civil... Last one. Will the civilizational revitalization of China thoroughly eradicate the white supremacy? Thank you.
Okay, we'll try to eradicate it. I think we'll take that. Okay, stability of China, satellite technology, 5G, currency, and will Britain become like China after Brexit? Right. Is that the implication, anyway?
every week there's a new model of what Britain should be after Brexit. Sometimes it's Luxembourg, Singapore, Switzerland, Norway.
Okay,
sadly, just like China will remain China, Britain's going to remain Britain. let me go back to, you know, Gideon, I think you made an important point, but you used the word if twice in your comments, right? You said, if there is conflict, it could derail everything. If China collapses, which was also one of the questions. Sure. But at this point, it's just if, right? And the thing is, the last 30 years, Asians have done a good job of keeping their geopolitical tensions at bay. And there have been some very nasty close calls, absolutely right to flag those, where, again, sometimes without U.S. diplomatic intervention, things could have blown up. But keeping their geopolitical tensions on one side and the geopolitical economic convergence on the other, and that they show evidence of being able to continue to do that, even in some of the most contentious dynamics, including China, Japan. So let me just move on to the currency question. And there, again, it's not, we posit this binary choice again. Is it a dollar world or an RMB world? It's actually a multipolar currency world increasingly, euro, yen, and so on. And there isn't going to be an outright substitution of one by the other. So in some areas of bilateral trade or of reserve currency holdings, you can imagine if there's a petro RMB in the coming years, some kind of a Saudi-Chinese arrangement, then you're obviously going to have some shift of reserves away from the dollar. Certainly in trade settlement, China has increased, and other countries have increased their holdings of RMB to increase trade with China. But none of that amounts to a wholesale shift. So the end state to be looking for is not, does the RMB replace the dollar? Because that's never going to happen. The end state to be looking for is just, or the process is to follow the kind of shift towards a multipolar world. And don't forget the role of, you know, cryptocurrencies and other sort of liquidity mechanisms.
Just for a second. The dollar is still ultimately totally dominant, really. About over 60% of all transactions are done through the dollar.
Right.
The renminbi has to be pegged to the dollar, as I understand.
It's not convertible.
It's not convertible.
Okay, it's not convertible. Okay.
That's
the keeping.
That's the keeping.
So it's a bit more dollar dominant. And I think the implication of the question is, therefore, who's running the world monetary system and who has the greatest degree of leverage over it? And that, therefore, still gives.
Still.
As I'm understanding the question.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, but it's not.
Yeah, totally. Right. No, I think that's a key point.
And as you know, as you know, on this, it's precisely though the weaponization of the monetary system. Everything has to be weaponized these days in order to get attention. So let's just throw that in there. You know, the weaponization of the system actually has consequences that are obviously the opposite sometimes of what is intended. Because now it's inspiring Europeans to want to set up a parallel structure of special purpose vehicles to deal with Iran and so on. And so forth. So again, be careful about blips versus trends, right? And even as we know, you know, the reversal in some ways of the trend in the share of reserves held in dollars that really reverted to reinforce the dollar after the financial crisis in the next decade may well continue on the trend that had started the decade before, which was to diversify. And many countries are moving towards those trade-weighted baskets in terms of their reserves, which obviously means a slightly lower share of the dollar. But on the sanctions,
yeah, you jump in now.
Yeah, no. I'm a little bit more kind of on the side that the dollar is very, very powerful, and its power is yet to be properly challenged, because I think that the RMB can only really be a challenger and an alternative if it becomes a convertible currency, a fully convertible currency. Otherwise, people aren't going to want their money stuck in it if they can't get it out. And as I understand it, China's still deeply reluctant to make that move because of fear of capital flight. And also, I think that people would be very reluctant to keep their money in RMB as long as they don't fully trust the Chinese legal system. I mean, the American legal system has its problems, but there's still more of a sense that you've got the rule of law in the United States and an established currency. And as you say, the U.S. has been translating this into raw political power. We saw that with the way that the SWIFT was weaponized, to use your word. And I don't yet see, lots of people are really unhappy about it, but nobody's yet been able to figure out a way of breaking it. And you mentioned that the Europeans thinking about this special purpose vehicle over Iran, but they're not really getting anywhere. Because as we saw with the Huawei case, mm-hmm. the Americans are very happy to use extraterritorial law, and if you use the dollar, you're in their net. So I was told that the Germans considering, or maybe they could use the Bundesbank as a direct link to the Iranians, were told, well, potentially that could put the Bundesbank president at risk of arrest if he went to the United States, and at which point they kind of rethought. The dollar is, I think, perhaps even more than the U.S. military now, kind of key to America's global power, and maybe they'll abuse it to the point where alternatives are set up, but I don't see anyone yet getting there.
Sure,
I'm going to
bring you in here.
Sure, I agree with Gideon what said. I mean, there has no really fully open for capital account inside China. So for at the individual level, anyone who wants to take cash around $5,000, you have to declare to the local, you know, local foreign currency agency. So I really didn't really see the future of the so-called capital account opening. And secondly, if we actually look into the basket composition for the IMF, RMB is the smallest. It's run only around 1% so far after, you know, being introduced as being basket currency since October 2016. So I think it's really a long process. And perhaps, I mean, the United States will use the dollar as a weapon somehow when it comes to the issues like in North Korea. So I see some trouble brewing over there. Now, just to answer that gentleman's question on the division between central government and the provincial government, and I think you're absolutely right. And Xi Jinping by no way is as powerful as has been described in this part of the world. And all he has done in the past 18 months or so is almost like a response to the provincial leaders and provincial governors. I mean, classic example, look at the Belt and Road Initiative. Belt and Road Initiative in China, 32 provinces, and each province and try to present its own idea how the entire initiative should be run. So it's a very much a fragmented country. Now, for Xi Jinping, for his challenge is how to firstly, on the one hand, maintain some kind of stability at the central level, but also make sure all these warlords, the provincial warlords, are very happy with his leadership. So for me, really, I agree with Gideon. The real challenge for China is more on the domestic policy front. It's more about, firstly, how is Xi Jinping going to managing a populist agenda, make sure the ordinary people are happy, but secondly, also how he could satisfy the existed vested interest groups.
Okay, I'm going to go for another round of questions. Please get their hands up. Anybody over here? Anybody down here? The gentleman is driving it.
Why don't we start with you and then come over to you, is that okay?
So given China's involvement in Africa, especially in terms of infrastructure projects, how do you think that relationship will develop and also impact Africa as the continent, I guess its relationship with the US and also Europe as well, given that China doesn't really have these, I guess, colonial kind of ties and history?
Pomerantz sort of classified sort of history really for Pomerantz, who has a book called The Great Divergence, so he sort of classifies the sort of really history from the 17th century onwards as sort of the divergence of power from the east to the west. And judging by what I've been hearing tonight, do you think there's a sort of another great divergence where this time sort of power and sort of military and economic is sort of going the other way, sort of moving towards the east?
Pomerantz theory. There's a lady here, please. Yeah, I'm going to try and get balance in the questions. Yeah, please. Hi there.
Hi. My question was about a comment that you made earlier about Asia being politically very divided, which is absolutely true. But a lot of the discussion has been in the context of alliances with the US or China, but there's a huge part of Asia and many, many countries who believe in the, who still believe in the non-aligned movement, right? And we haven't brought that up as yet. There's a lot of them. Some, of course, do fall firmly within the US camp and, you know, Japan, Korea, blah, blah. Some, of course, are in the China camp, but there are actually more countries that are outside either the US or the China side and are firmly in the non-aligned movement. So is there anything that you could comment on that? How does that change that balance of power and your analysis of these issues?
Good question on the NAM, member at World, Bandung and all that, 1954. And a lady over here, yeah. So I'm trying to get as many people in as possible. Yeah. but I didn't want to get balance in the question. Yeah, please.
One question, please. It's about the political transformation. I have a question. A political transformation in Asia, is it possible for more stability? And if yes, who could be a leadership now?
Okay, stability, transition, and leadership. I think we'll take those.
We're running out of time.
I think we are. That's the other thing. I'm sorry about that. There's so many good questions coming up.
Okay.
Why don't you kick off?
Lightning round. On the internal, I just wanted to remind everyone, you know, when we were talking about Asian politics and political, you know, transitions and stability of regimes, let's bear in mind that, again, Asia is more than just China, right? If we can take one thing away from this conversation, there are 5 billion people in Asia, only 1.5 billion in China. As the gentleman said earlier, China is China, and that's what China will be. In the next 4 months, there are elections in India, Indonesia, and the Philippines. That's about 1.7 billion people in 3 countries. There are more people living in democracies in Asia than the rest of the planet Earth, right? Just to be clear. So will, someone asked earlier, you know, will other countries follow the China model? Will they become like China? The answer is no. They will become like what themselves. They have history operates in these layers. You have so many post-colonial countries with a democratic heritage that they gained from, you know, British tutelage and the European experience. They are going to evolve in their own way. No Asian wakes up in the morning outside of China, and there are many Chinese who wake up in the morning thinking they would prefer to live under a different regime. I don't know any Asian outside of China who wakes up in the morning saying, I want to live under a Chinese government. And that will never happen. So you don't need to worry at all about that whatsoever.
Is this because of the benign influence of the British Empire?
It could well be. Which is a perfect segue. It's a perfect segue to the question about Africa. Why? Well, one of the legacies of the British Empire was circulating millions of South Asians to Africa. And when we talk about Africa's future, we somehow conveniently neglect the fact that there are 3 million people of Indian origin living in Africa. But suddenly, it's just a new African colony. As if, again, the intervening centuries of independence, sovereignty, transparency, democracy, and so forth play no role whatsoever. But, of course, they do. I have a whole section of the book on Afro-Eurasia, which is the term that historians use when they're talking about the sort of, you know, 14th, 15th, 16th centuries of Indian Ocean trade. And in that process, you have many African countries that, again, are pushing back to some degree against unilateral Chinese-dominated projects. And where they cancel projects with China, they hand them over to Indians or to Malaysians or to others. And much of what we're seeing right now, again, versus the blip versus the trend, the blip we see is China going in and doing everything. The trend is that China has first mover advantage. It goes in and builds lots of infrastructure. Some countries it actually abandons entirely, and other Asians go in. But it's not a news story for us. If India goes and operates a factory in Ethiopia, that's never going to make the Financial Times, right? But when China goes in and...
Slow day, Mike.
On a slow day. No.
That was mean.
Gideon had a great report. He said on a slow day it might, but it's not geopolitically sexy.
Hey.
It's not geopolitically sexy.
Watch Gideon Rackman's column tomorrow morning.
But we are defining Africa through the lens of China, which is wrong. Africa should be understood through the lens of Africa. Secondarily, through a much broader composite set of relations, of which China is an important part, but not the only part. And the further you look into the future, you might well see that it's less Chinese than we think it is. And, just the final point about the divergence and convergence. Look, as I said at the end, I see a multipolar world. There's no question that economically that's going to continue to be the case. And that has strategic translations. The world is becoming much more regionalized than we tend to think. There is a North American system, a European system, an Asian system, and there, in the Asian system, there's a growing degree of self-sufficiency almost, and you can see this in the institutions that we didn't talk much about, such as the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and so forth. So we should be looking at those internal dynamics. But again, I don't believe necessarily. And it's funny, you said you'd use the D word in your previous book. I've been accused of being a declinist, and yet I come around to what is actually an original geopolitical paradigm from the 19th century, which is that of more longitudinal pan regions that have a good degree of self-sufficiency, not autarky. There's no need to pursue autarky per se, but you still have a deep strength in each of our systems in the world.
It's a good idea to avoid the D word because it shuts down discussion.
It sure does. Yeah.
Cherry.
Sure. Not sure it's D word or R word. I mean...
Now, the thing on the question on China-Africa, I think we somehow experienced slightly change from Beijing. After last year's forecast, China-Africa Forum, and Xi Jinping put forward a really big number offering direct loans to African countries. And he got really heavily criticized by the, you know, by the press and by the ordinary people, saying we have so much poverty inside our country, and why we still offer this kind of foreign assistance to a continent which is so remote from us. So we're now, I now begin to question, you know, what is the purpose of this foreign policy? So that's somehow troublesome in the way to come. Now, on the non-alliance movement, and I think China also played that card very hard as well, because one of the fundamental principles for the Chinese foreign policy has always been, we're not looking for alliances, we're always looking for partners. And that message has always been come across when China dealt with so-called South-Souths or China's collaboration with countries like Central Asia and South Asia. So I think we shouldn't forget that non-alliance movement in here. Now, stability, transformation. And I don't think the China's Communist Party model could be replicated for any other Asian country. I mean, Vietnamese Communist Party certainly are very different from the Chinese Communist Party because the size, the history of the country are completely different. So I think, really, I think each country should funding its own path to somehow to become a developed country in itself rather than just relying on so-called certain model.
Okay.
Yeah. Gideon? Just on that, the picking up on the non-aligned thing and also how China deals with thing. I mean, I think the rhetoric is very much partnership and non-aligned and so on. But certainly other countries in the region will often tell you, actually, the Chinese think still in a kind of tributary system kind of way, and they're very hierarchical. And, okay, look, the Japanese are hardly impartial on this, but they're, you know, it was interesting talking to some Japanese officials shortly after the recent APEC summit in Papua New Guinea, where there was a kind of a blow-up and the Chinese became very upset at the way that and they said, you know, in the end, the Chinese had just resorted to shouting at people because they said, look, they don't really, they don't, haven't mastered, you know, strong-arming people, but in a kind of quiet way, that when patterns of behavior that they expect break down, they don't quite know how to cope. That was their argument. And I think this, but more broadly, I think this whole question of is it a new tributary system that is expected and that is emerging, or is it a partnership model, is going to be very important to this question that you spoke about, which is how does China manage the presentation of its rise to the rest of Asia and to the rest of the world? And the question of non-aligned, I mean, talking about India as well, I mean, I think India very instinctively, you know, thinks of itself as part of the non-aligned movement, but it struck me on recent trips to India that their whole perception of themselves is very much in flux because there are three or four models they could go. One is this very traditional South model that India represents the global South, the non-aligned movement, you know, drawn from post-colonial period. Another is that they could see themselves in a way, a Parakana type way, as part of a rising Asia and adopt an Asian identity, which would kind of put them close to China in some ways, that there's an identity of interest there or identity of what's happening to them as powers. But another would be to say, actually, we're worried by the rise of China and we're going to have to kind of modify this non-aligned bit and get in bed with the Americans. And there's the strong element of that going on. Although they in no way want to be manipulated by the US, they can see them coming in that sense. They don't want to be just a part of an American containment strategy. But I think that the Indians have stepped up cooperation with Japan, stepped up cooperation with America, and it's very China-focused.
The
whole Indo-Pacific thing. And the fourth problem for them is, can they escape actually the biggest problem being Pakistan? And that's always going to be what defines their relationship. So I think India is in a really interesting place, and the non-aligned thing is part of it, but it's less defining for them than it used to be.
Okay, I think that'll have to be the last word. Just a few announcements before I move to thank our speakers and to thank you for your good questions. I'm told that there's a 15-minute book signing. That's by you, because it's your book, will take place... I can't sign on your behalf. There's a 15-minute book signing will take place just outside the lecture theatre, so there's books on sale out there, and Parag, you're going to have to run up there and sign it, and that'll add value. Maybe. Also, I have to say that this was audio podcast and will be is it has been live streamed, just in case you said anything wrong, which I probably did. But anyway, there will be podcasts to follow. And could you fill in the event feedback form, please? It would be very helpful. Anyway, with no more ado, I'd just like to thank you all for your great questions. Thank Parag, thank Sherry, and thank Lillian.